Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, John Gregg shares the thinking behind Farmtario, Ontario's new source for ag news.
We think that there are some areas where we can better serve the market, and that's especially in digital platforms, and that's what we launched this week at the London Farm Show.
Jeremy Symes of The Western Producer reports on growing concerns over rural crime. Martin Rice of the Canadian Agri-Food Trade Alliance gives us his views on NAFTA negotiations.
Who knows what other kind of threats or potential new tariff might be proposed.
And our own Bruce Burnett takes a look at weather and markets. All on Between the Rows with this week's host, Robert Arneson.
Hi, I'm Robert Arneson of The Western Producer, and welcome to another episode of Between the Rows. First up, Glacier Farm Media operates a long list of newspapers, magazines, and websites in Canada, from Country Guide to Grain News to The Western Producer. This week, Glacier Farm Media added another product to its lineup. On March 7th, the company launched Farmtario, an agricultural publication for Ontario. Here to talk about it is John Gregg, the editor of Farmtario. Hi, John.
Hi, Robert. How are you today?
Thanks for coming on the show. So, first off, can you describe Farmtario to me? What will it look like? What should farmers in Ontario expect?
Farmtario is a new publication for farmers, simply put. But we think that there are some areas where we can better serve the market, and that's especially in digital platforms, and that's what we launched this week at the London Farm Show. And that includes website, email newsletters, and our social media platforms. They're all live now. And then, because we know farmers really still like to read a newspaper, we're launching a bi-weekly newspaper that's going to go to all farmers in Ontario, and you'll see it with our the same time as our Ag Dealer publication as of this spring. So watch for that Farmtario newspaper coming every 2 weeks in the spring.
So just so I'm understanding this, is this something that just comes in people's mailboxes or they have to get a subscription? Like, how does that work?
It's going to be it's not going to be a subscription publication. It's just going to come into mailboxes of farmers across the province. Now, if you don't live on a production farm and you still want the publication, we will be happy to sell your subscription to the publication. But we've had our Ag Dealer publication that's going out monthly with Ag Dealer's equipment listings. It's going out monthly to farmers in Ontario for a number of years, and now it has moved to every 2 weeks, bi-weekly, and then it will help provide a platform that we can send Farmtario out with it at the same time.
So how do you see this publication? You know, Ontario agriculture is quite diverse. You know, you've got a large horticulture sector. Obviously, dairy is quite large. Like, what's your plan? Like, how as an editor are you going to focus your coverage?
Well, our goal is to be a general farm newspaper for the sector across Ontario. And you're right, that's part of the fun and part of the challenge of being an editor of a publication for agriculture in Ontario is that we do have such an extraordinarily diverse sector. So our main filter through which we're wanting to put our stories is you know, what's the insight for the farmer? If there's not an insight for the farmer, then why are we doing the story? And then certainly we'll be focusing more broadly on how that insight for a farmer will apply across the sector. So we hope that there's going to be information for everybody in most of the stories, although we know there will be certainly different sectors who are going to be interested in different parts of the coverage. We're going to try to focus on different sectors at different points when the news is important for those particular sectors. And then in general, there's quite a bit of news, trade news, especially these days, an enormous amount of trade news and political news in Ontario related to agriculture that plays across the sector. And we plan to really focus on covering that well also.
So I guess for folks who don't know you, can you tell us a bit about yourself? How did you become the editor of this publication? What did you do before this?
Sure. Glacier Farm Media, I think, has done a good job of going in and hiring people in Ontario who know the Ontario market, who've been there for a long time. So that includes, you know, myself and our and some of our other sales and marketing staff as well. I have worked in agriculture journalism pretty much my entire career. I founded a small biweekly farm publication long ago at the start of my career. I worked for Ontario Farmer for about 14 years there as one of the editors, and then I worked in communications for a few years, and then for the last year and a half, I've been back working for Glacier Farm Media, helping to bump up their Ontario coverage even before we moved this project forward with Glacier's number of publications on across the country. They decided they needed somebody who knew who could cover Ontario for them. So I've been doing that, and then my expertise falls right in line with launching Farmtario as we go forward. So it's pretty exciting time. It'll be a challenge, but it's pretty exciting time.
So last one, just on that note, what kind of excites you about this opportunity? What are you looking forward to as being the editor of this new publication? That's kind of a unique thing in a career of a journalist to be the head heading up a new publication.
Yeah, you're right. It doesn't happen all that often, so it is exciting. So I think there's new ways of telling the story of agriculture in Ontario. I think there's especially relating to how we can integrate the timeliness and the multimedia of digital. We're going to be doing video. We're going to be, you know, contributing to our Between the Rows podcast. And of course, we're going to have print as news happens online. And then we're also going to be able to take a deeper look at things in print as well. And I really look forward to the depth that Glacier Farm Media can help me bring to the content. You know, we've got these well-respected publications across the country, and I look forward to being able to bring some of that content and to collaborate with some of my colleagues across the country to hopefully produce some good, timely, deep content that will help farmers make decisions on their farm.
All right. Well, thanks, John. I've been speaking with John Gregg, the editor of Farmtario, a new farm publication in Canada. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Robert.
I'm Robert Arneson, and you're listening to Between the Rows. Later on in the show, we'll get an update on NAFTA and the possibility of a trade war in North America. Up next, break-ins and stolen vehicles have always been a problem in rural Canada, but in the last few years, the number of property crimes has spiked, especially in Alberta. Many landowners aren't sure what they legally can or can't do when confronting someone on their property. Joining us to talk about this heated topic is Jeremy Symes, a reporter with the Western Producer at Edmonton. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Robert. Thanks for having me.
So you recently were at a meeting in Lloydminster where this topic of what you can and can't do legally when someone comes on your property. Can you just tell us a bit more about that meeting? Who was there and who was speaking?
Yeah, sure. So it was the AgriVisions conference in Lloydminster a few weeks ago. And the two speakers there were legal experts. One was Glenn Jacques. He is a former Crown prosecutor with Saskatchewan. And then there was Don Smith, who is a defense lawyer, but he has a private practice in Lloydminster. And yeah, the topic was about rural crime and, you know, what farmers should and shouldn't do when they're confronted by it on their property.
So what did these experts have to say? What was the main point of their message?
Yeah, so the key message I thought was that, you know, farmers shouldn't escalate the situation because they could face, you know, criminal charges if they do so. And they pointed to a number of examples that stood out. So say a farmer gets into a fight with a criminal on his property. If the farmer throws the last punch, then the farmer could actually get charged with assault for doing that. Say a farmer, you know, points his gun at a criminal and shouts at him to get off his land just to scare him off. Well, if they do that, then they could also get charged with assault, but they could also get charged with uttering threats. say a criminal steals a truck and the farmer wants to chase him off in a different truck, and the farmer's going high speeds down the highway, well, they could get charged with dangerous driving for doing that. So there are a number of charges that could result from this, and obviously I think that didn't sit well with too many there.
So just on that note, what was the kind of feeling in the room? What was the reaction for the folks in the crowd? I'm assuming it was mostly farmers and landowners in the crowd?
Yeah, so I would say there was over 150 people there, and so it was well attended. And the feeling was frustration, for sure. There was a poignant moment in the meeting, I thought, where one farmer got up, and he was saying, you know, he asked the crowd, how many of you are experiencing rural crime in your properties, and are you frustrated by it? And almost everyone raised their hand, and so it was really telling just to get a sense of how everyone was feeling. I spoke with a number of farmers after, but one farmer I was talking with mentioned, you know, he feels that criminals have more rights than him in a way, where they can come onto his property and steal something and he can't really do anything about it, or he could face charges. Now, the experts say, no, that's not the case. You know, everyone's rights are equal. But still, it's just how lots of people are feeling. He was adding that, you know, there should be more RCMP resources to help farmers out. There should be longer criminal sentences, because he feels a lot of these criminals aren't learning their lessons, I guess, if, you know, they're only in jail for a month or two. Now, in response to that, a lot of the legal experts were saying, you know, we understand your frustration. And they were also mentioning maybe we could do more with mental health and get to the root of the problem. And, you know, that answer, some people were for it. Some people just thought, you know, because it's mental health, it could just be an excuse. But they were saying, no, if we get to the root of the problem, which usually is mental health, maybe over time, we could see less rural crime if, you know, people's mental health is solved or whatever.
So I guess the question becomes then, legally, what can you do if somebody comes on your property and, you know, they're maybe stealing something or doing something? Well, I guess they're trespassing, first of all, but what are you supposed to do according to these legal experts?
Right. Yeah, good question. So what they said, what you should do is, you know, don't confront the thief, you know, stay in your home, call the police, you know, take photos of anything, gather as much evidence as you can. That answer, obviously, it didn't really sit well with people, but they were saying legally, like, that's what you should do, because if you go above and beyond that and escalate the situation, you could face charges. So, yeah.
So going forward, I mean, I don't think this story is going away. It seems like this is quite the sort of point of conflict in rural Alberta and rural Western Canada right now, this sort of tension around rural crime. Was that the feeling you got at the meeting there?
Yeah, it's definitely not going away anytime soon. You know, the mood of the meeting, it was very tense. Everyone was really engaged. I think people really care about this topic. So yeah, we'll see what happens over time. We'll see if, I guess, our politicians start to take it a bit more seriously. But yeah, it's definitely not going away.
All right. Well, thanks, Jeremy. I've been speaking with Jeremy Symes, a reporter with the Western Producer in Edmonton. And we've been talking about challenges and problems with rural crime in Alberta. Thanks, Jeremy.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Robert Arneson, and this is Between the Rows. The seventh round of negotiations for NAFTA were held in Mexico City last week. The talks were grinding away until Donald Trump, as he often does, threw a grenade into the conversation. On March 1st, Trump announced tariffs of 25% on U.S. imports of steel and 10% on imports of aluminum. Here to talk about NAFTA and the impact of the tariffs is Martin Rice. Martin is a representative of the Canadian Agri-Food Trade Alliance. Martin was in Mexico City for the NAFTA negotiations. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
So, obviously, the big news coming out of this round of negotiations were the Trump tariffs. What can you sort of describe the reaction at the meeting after the tariffs were announced on March 1st?
Well, the announcement came as something that was, well, A, it was a surprise for everyone involved, but B, it was not seen as NAFTA linked. Initially, it was seen as something that had been contemplated for some time that was probably aimed at other trading partners than Canada and the U.S. or Canada and Mexico. The thinking was that there was a great deal of interest, seen as a likelihood or as having some possibility of having Canada exempted from them, just based on past experience. So it wasn't until yesterday when this was this came out of the administration, President Trump particularly, that this was now being suggested as a way to deal with NAFTA, and it was the first time really it was explicitly linked to NAFTA negotiations.
So when you saw that tweet and heard news reports of that, was that kind of caught you off guard that this is sort of a tactic used to get leverage within the negotiations? Like, did that catch you by surprise?
Well, yes, and that's the norm, I guess, for dealing with the current administration and dealing with these negotiations. It was actually, in my mind, I was thinking that this is an interesting tactic that who knows what it could be used for. I was thinking as much kind of to get some leverage with China than in Canada. Now, no question, when this comes out, regardless of whether or not it's specifically linked to NAFTA, it further clouds the picture of, wow, how does one deal with the United States on trade negotiations these days?
Can you just expand upon that a bit? What are you trying to say?
Well, when the country that you already have a free trade agreement with indicates that they're going to impose tariffs, but these tariffs will be maybe withdrawn if we reach the deal that we like on NAFTA. So it's a very negative approach to trying to reach a positive outcome. Who knows what other kind of threats or potential new tariffs might be proposed. It's being done under provisions of national security for the United States, but I don't think anything limits steel and aluminum
right
to that category. So it just increases the amount of uncertainty over what exactly is the context, the expectations of the U.S. in this negotiation, and to what extent are their negotiators really dealing with a coherent set of objectives and a game plan in this NAFTA negotiation, such that the other sides are going to want to engage as fully yep. as necessary to negotiate such a complex trade agreement as we have here.
I guess what makes it more complicated, too, is that you have one message from the president, and then somebody like Paul Ryan comes out and says these steel and aluminum tariffs are a bad idea. So it gets confusing for other nations because it's kind of like, okay, who really is representing the U.S. here? I guess that creates a strange dynamic.
Well, and does the U.S. fully recognize its own interests? Because it's so widespread, the U.S. industry negative reaction to this, other than perhaps the ones that are specifically going to benefit from these tariffs. But, their own customers in the steel and aluminum industry would be severely impacted by, tariffs of this stature. And it just, NAFTA has nurtured such an interdependent North American economy that one cannot place a tariff, anything of this stature, 5 or 10 and 25% tariffs, that isn't going to severely impact not only the trading partners it's targeting, but its own industry,
right,
which is, as we know, in agriculture has become so much a matter of specializing in your areas of strength. And U.S. has its strengths, we have ours, and NAFTA has fostered, both countries, all three countries, utilizing those strengths and to make North America as competitive as possible in the world economy.
So just moving away from the tariffs for a second, last week in Mexico City, there was a U.S. group, Farmers for Free Trade, there, and they held a press conference. And the executive director of that group made the point very clearly, saying that trade isn't a zero-sum game where importers are the losers and exporters are the winners. Is that message having any impact on the NAFTA talks? Like, is that helpful, or is that changing the dynamic at all? Like, what does that mean when a group of U.S. farmers come forward with that kind of message?
Well, I think it's one that agrees, you know, very much with our own and the Mexico government. I think actually that terminology, this is not a zero-sum game, is used by our trade minister, our foreign affairs minister, Freeland.
Yep.
It's a message that is very well understood, I believe, within the negotiating team of the U.S. It's one that doesn't seem, though, to have the impact on the administration, specifically the president and the commerce secretary and the U.S. trade representative. Those are three pretty key people in this process. But U.S. agriculture keeps pressing on that matter, and they are definitely getting the message through to Congress. And Congress has a big role in all of this. I can't be I'm not an expert to know exactly what the intricacies, I guess, of U.S. Legislation versus administration, areas of jurisdiction, areas of authority, but the Congress understands this extremely well, and they are, I think, getting increasingly active in impressing upon the administration the need to avoid hurting so much of the American economy to advance the interests of one or two, you know,
yep,
narrow sectors.
So last one here. So, you know, it's been quite an eventful last few days here or last week. What's your sense of where this is headed? Do these tariffs radically change the course of NAFTA and how things are going to move forward? Or what do you expect in the coming weeks?
Well, I think the Canadian government is going to resist letting these two activities get linked. This matter of steel and aluminum tariffs could easily have come at a time when there is no NAFTA negotiation taking place. And there's far more kind of things at play here than NAFTA negotiations. And, you know, it is a very dangerous game to play, is when you kind of respond to something that shouldn't be happening in the first place and enter into a negotiation to stop that from happening. I think, you know, the fact that we did... And 10 other countries renegotiate the TPP without the U.S., I think is a suggestion that Canada does have options, that Canada doesn't have to, is not subject to the directives of any other country, regardless of the size of the trading relationship. And I think Canada has, you know, determined to find a way to make NAFTA a modernized trade agreement, and is determined to retain, to the extent possible, you know, fully open and modernized trade relationship between the three countries. But it is a negotiation. It's not a matter of one country directing or imposing its wishes and the others. It has to be negotiated, and it has to be a deal that all three countries are going to be prepared to defend and advance to put into effect in their own each of their own countries.
All right, Martin, thanks for coming on the show.
Very good. I'm pleased to have been asked. Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Martin Rice, a representative of the Canadian Agri-Food Trade Alliance. Martin was here to talk about the North American Free Trade Agreement and recent tariffs announced by the Trump administration. I'm Robert Arneson, and this is Between the Rows. Over the last 5 weeks, the value of the loonie has been sliding, going from over 80 cents in January to below 77 cents in recent days. That's, of course, 70 cents US. The dip is bad news for Canadians going to Florida for spring break, but possibly good news for exporters of ag commodities in Western Canada. Join us to talk about it is Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media Director of Weather and Market Information. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
So can you tell us what's going on with the loonie? Is this all related to NAFTA and tariffs, or is there something bigger going on here?
Well, I certainly think the NAFTA and tariff issues with the U.S. are primarily driving the loonie downwards, especially the announcement of tariffs, because that would have a material impact on the Canadian economy, and it's a bit disconcerting, too, for international markets. And in that case, usually, ironically, what happens is money comes out of the loonie and goes into the U.S. dollar. So we're seeing pressure on the loonie from that front, from the NAFTA negotiations or the lack of negotiations that seem to be going on, or the very slow progress, at least. And I think thirdly, fundamentally, the slower Canadian economy, we had some relatively poor GDP growth numbers from the last quarter of 2017 at 1.7% annualized growth, indicating that our economy is slowing as well. I think all of those factors are starting to drive the loonie downwards. In my opinion, actually, the loonie is getting closer to what the real valuation should be, which is in this 74, 76 cent range, I think is probably where we'll settle out when things are all said and done here. But again, that depends on the Twitter universe and what happens with President Trump over the next few months.
So I guess the question is, what does that all mean for the grain and oilseed prices in Western Canada? Is that like a good thing for farmers having a weaker loonie? Is it that simplistic, or?
It is that simplistic in terms of our cash prices that you see at the farm gate in Canadian dollars. So again, basis levels, let's say for a U.S.-priced commodity like wheat where you're pricing off U.S. futures, that basis level should get better for you. Cash prices in general should get better for you, even in things like canola, even though they're priced in Canadian dollars, all of the math is related to the U.S.-Canadian exchange rate. So I think they're basically it's a positive thing for our export sector here. So that's the good news. I think the sort of temporary bad news here is probably in terms of inputs, and especially, I'd say, fertilizers for the spring. Again, the spot prices for those commodities will be going up based on the weaker dollar here. So it's, again, positive on one end and not so positive on other ends. I think the other thing to think about in terms of the steel imports is just, if you look on our farm or any other farm, there is a lot of steel parked around the yard, and the price for those pieces of equipment probably are going to go up here for those pieces of equipment that are made in the United States if this tariff goes through. So it's another thing to think about maybe in the more long term. For here, for now, it probably doesn't make a difference, but in the longer term, it could make a difference as well.
So just sticking with prices for a second, over the last, month or so, or maybe a bit longer, wheat futures in Chicago have been climbing. I imagine that's related to the weather issues in the U.S. Midwest and Southern Plains. What do you think about what's happening with wheat prices right now? Is there going to be a lasting effect into the spring? Or like, how long do you think is it going to persist, this rally?
Well, this rally still has some legs here, but because mostly of the Southern Plains, in terms of the Midwest, there are some flooding concerns in some of the soft red winter wheat areas. But I would say that's relatively minor in the market's mind compared to the drought in Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas especially. This week we got some further numbers as those states are starting to report their weekly ratings in terms of crop conditions, and 77% of Oklahoma's crop is poor to very poor. 50% of Kansas's crop is in those two categories. So you can see that the situation is serious there. And the forecast for rain, at least through the middle of the month here of March, is going to be pretty sparse. So it doesn't look like those conditions are going to improve. So the market's going to take its cue from the weather. When we get a weather forecast that looks like it's going to be wet, and especially if it does occur eventually here, the market probably will come back. So in a way, it's going to be somewhat temporary, but this is very similar to our drought concerns last spring. We're in a weather market, and there's probably further legs upward to go. Going into this event, funds were extremely short wheat. They've now started to get that position neutralized and even gone long a bit in Kansas City. Overall, though, from a world perspective, there's lots of wheat around. There's no problems developing in Europe or the Black Sea region yet. You would need to see another issue on the weather side with a major exporting region before these price increases were going to be permanent.
So just sticking with weather, obviously, as most people know, in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, we've got a substantive dump of snow to kind of begin March. What is this going to mean for like seeding and soil conditions in on the prairies this year? Obviously, I'm thinking this is helpful. What's your sense of the situation?
Well, it's certainly helpful. It does not essentially get rid of all the concerns we have about poor subsoil moisture, especially in the southern regions of Saskatchewan, where it's extremely short in those regions. And all those areas did get some precipitation out of this snowfall event over the past week or so. It only gives us probably good starting topsoil moisture. But that was a lot better than we were looking at a week ago when there was virtually no snow cover in a lot of regions, and the melt had provided very little in terms of moisture. Now it looks like most areas of the prairies now are going to have pretty good levels of soil moisture. I guess the counter to this is in some of the northern areas, we also picked up some snow, and those areas weren't nearly as dry. And so we would be a bit concerned about how quickly we get out into fields. But generally speaking, this is a very, very good event. And it does improve not only in the prairies, but also in parts of North Dakota and Montana, the prospects for the upcoming year. So something to be aware of in the markets, especially the spring wheat markets here. It looks like we're going to have some reasonable planting conditions for the crop in the upcoming year here.
All right. Well, thanks, Bruce. I've been speaking with Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media Director of Weather and Markets Information. Thanks for coming on the show, Bruce.
Thanks.
All right. I'll just wrap up the show here. And then we're good to go. That's it for this week's show, the second one of March. I'm Robert Arneson of The Western Producer. Thanks for listening.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.